Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to part two of episode number 90 of my 60 music podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Hello! So first of all, I'd like to welcome all of you to part two of episode number 90 of my 60 music podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or in iHeartRadio, or on Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is this? I'm just going to give you a brief description of what the show is all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 24-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a huge 60 music fan slash expert slash nerd. And each week of this podcast, I take one song by one artist in the 60s and split the show into two parts. First part of the show, I talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good, or why I think it sucks, and do my own personal analysis on the arrangement of the song, which will include the chords, melody, and lyrics. And the second part of the show, I dig deep into the history behind that track. In that part of the show, I talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, who are the musicians in the track, whether that be the session musicians or the band members themselves, history behind the song, where they wrote the song, the artists that recorded it, plus the musicians that played on the song, and the guy that produced it, and also where the studio was located at, where they recorded the song, as well as the label the song was released on, where that label was located at, and the peak position the song made up originally in the Billboard Hot 100 charts when it first came out in the year and month it was released. All that is in the second part of the show. Now, before we move on to this week's episode of the podcast, I want to let you guys know that I was at the Love and Spoonful tribute show last night, and it was a lot of fun. It was awesome. It was really, really cool. I got to see a bunch of really, really talented musicians who not all of them I know personally, but some of them I do. But they just really, really did a good job paying tribute to this incredible band from the 60s. They did their song so amazingly well. And I want to let you guys know that, unfortunately, I did not get the chance to meet any of the original members of Loving Spoonful. Now, honestly, that's on me because I decided to get a cheap balcony seat, which is definitely higher up in the theater, and I didn't get a VIP ticket. Now, had I gotten a VIP ticket, I definitely probably would have met the original members of the band, what happened was that the original guys that were part of the reunion show last night, they were all signing autographs and they were all hanging out and with people who bought VIP tickets, and basically they were, taking pictures with them and everything. So I decided not to get a VIP ticket, even though I probably could have, but that's just on me personally. So unfortunately, I didn't get the chance to meet any of the original members of Loving Spoonful. So as of right now, the next interview episode of my podcast for episode 100 is still up in the air. I still don't know who I'm going to get as the next interview for my podcast, but I do have a couple people in mind. It'd be ideal if I can get somebody really big, like a big name for episode 100, but, it just depends on if I can get a hold of them, first of all, and if they want to do it, really, I might have to settle for another sort of, side musician, like a session player or an engineer or a member of a band from the 60s that wasn't, like, the main front guy, but it'd be cool if I can get Tom Kenny, who's the voice of SpongeBob, on my show, but he's just a crazy, insanely busy guy, so I don't know, if that's going to happen as of right now, but I'll keep you guys posted when I figure out what is going to be the next interview episode of my podcast, who I'm going to talk to next for episode 100. I still got a little bit of time. This is episode 91, part 2 of episode 90, so I still got 9 more weeks left before I need to figure out who is going to be the next person I'm going to interview for episode 100. But, honestly, if I had finally gotten a VIP ticket, I probably would have gotten to talk to the guys at Love and Spoonful guys. But, I get what I pay for, really. So, but I'll definitely keep you guys posted when I get the next interview of my podcast book. But moving on, let's talk about the history behind last week's song and artist, and that was 1910 Fruitcone Company, and that was 123 Red Light. But first, let's dive into the history behind bubblegum music and exactly how and why this music became popular and where it had its place back in the late 60s. And, you know, and why it became extremely popular. And regardless of whether or not you like this genre of music or not, there definitely was a place for it, you know, in the late 60s. But first, let's talk about exactly what was going on as far as popular music in the late 60s. Because, again, this is kind of definitely far away from what was going on in the early 60s. But so here's the thing. So when people think of stereotypical music from the 60s, and this is just your average opinions, you know, the average person's, you know, opinion on what they think 60s music is. They oftentimes think of music that was infused by drug-taking hippies who dropped a lot of acid, and as a result, they wrote and produced some of the craziest rock songs with backward phase effects and fuzz-tone guitar effects. And while this was definitely true in the late 60s, you know, there was a specific group of people that would really be into that specific genre of music. And that was the hippies from San Francisco that were part of the Haight-Ashbury movement going to the Monterey Pop Festival up north in Woodstock in New York. But while there was that whole group of countercultural people who bought albums from groups like the Jimi Hendrix Experience and the Grateful Dead, and just what people considered a stereotype of what people think as 60s music, I mean, there was definitely that, you know, and those people were definitely older teenagers and young adults. I mean, that's the kind of music that they were into. They were listening to AM radio, and they were just really into that whole psychedelic, weird, you know, acid-tripping music. There were people younger than them, like preteens or kids, that were definitely not into groups like that at all. But when that psychedelic rock music was hot and hell as really extremely popular at this time, as I've talked about in podcasts before, like this was when FM radio came out, and this is when songs were getting longer, more than 3 minutes long and more experimental. And it was during this period that it seemed like anything goes as far as what was considered hit material to be played on the pop charts. I mean, you know, there were definitely more guitar solos happening in songs, and it was just, you know, the songs were getting longer than 3 minutes. It was just crazy. I mean, everything went from this really innocent, fun, happy thing that happened in the early 60s to this really weird, psychedelic, you know, drug-infused music that happened in the late 60s. I mean, just to give you an example, I mean, the Beatles went from doing fun, innocent songs like A Star Standing There to strange and experimental tunes like A Day in the Life. So if you think about it, when this happened, a certain age demographic was kind of being left behind when this music was blowing up and it was really popular and AM radio was really taking off. And there was this specific age demographic that was younger than the older teens and the adults, and these were like the preteens and the kids, and this specific age demographic craved music that was fun and lighthearted and not super serious or weird to say. And so that's when bubblegum music came to be, you know, because bubblegum music was essentially created for this specific age demographic who did not care for the really heavy, weird, and experimental psychedelic rock that a lot of the older Haight-Ashbury, you know, acid-dropping hippies were into. I mean, this specific genre of music was meant to be for the kids or the preteens who really just wanted something that was the polar opposite of the psychedelic rock stuff. But if you think about it, way before the end of 1967, the beginning of 1968, bubblegum music was around, and the guy who really invented it was somebody who was singing and writing his own songs in 1962, and that guy was Tommy Roe. But at the time, the genre wasn't even called bubblegum music. It was simply fun and catchy and happy songs that were huge on AM radio. But he created the whole bubblegum music formula with some of his earlier hits like Sweet Pea and Sheila and Hooray for Hazel. I mean, he was really a forerunner of that genre because he, you know, he infused the bubblegum spirit in some of the arrangements, some of those happy sort of, you know, major chords and some of those, you know, innocent, you know, fun with lyrics that didn't have any deep emotional meaning behind them. You know, he was a forerunner of that genre before people even really knew what to call it. But the big difference between Tommy Roe and the rest of the bubblegum genre is that Tommy was somebody who wrote and performed his own songs. Now, of course, he used session musicians and a producer on everything he did. But he wasn't a ghost singer singing on a bunch of different records under a bunch of different group names that had no real meaning behind them besides their name. But the point I'm trying to make is that he was definitely a self-contained artist, you know, and there wasn't anybody else behind his tunes besides him. I mean, it's not like, you know, he was singing the song in the studio and he had someone else sing his songs live when, so basically he was the same artist that performed on his songs, and he was the same guy that, you know, played these songs live, you know, when he was out touring. And whereas in the world of bubblegum music, you know, a lot of times what happened with bubblegum is that the music you heard on the radio was recorded and performed by session singers and musicians who were, for the most part, not real groups, even though in some cases it started out as a real band. But what happened was that the producers brought in a real band, you know, to play on, you know, their first album, you know. But then what happened was that when the song became a hit, they basically kept that band on the road and a lot of times brought in the lead singer and brought in their own musicians and songwriters to write the hit singles for them and play on the records for them while the band was out on the road busy promoting their first hit single or the hit singles that were current at that time. And I know that might sound confusing, so let's dive into that and figure out exactly what I mean by that. Okay, so even though in the early 60s there were teen idols like Brian Hyland and Ned Funicello and some other artists that, you know, were doing music that, you know, you could consider bubblegum, and, you know, even like British Invasion bands like Hermits were doing very bubblegum sounding music, you know, before it was even called bubblegum, but really the first real guys to brand that specific music as bubblegum were the guys that really developed and, you know, helped redefine the genre were these two songwriters / producers who are mainly producers, but their names were Jerry Kasnitz and Jeff Katz. I mean, basically it all started with those two guys. These guys were two New York-based producers who were looking to fill a void in the popular music world that they felt like they needed to be filled. I mean, they wanted to make music that was geared towards preteens who didn't want to listen to the heavy psychedelic rock music of the 60s and were into chewing bubblegum. And that's how that whole genre of music got started. So when they were looking to produce lighthearted and catching, fun, innocent music without too much emotional depth to it with the lyrics, and also nothing too weird as far as, you know, the effects used on the instruments, and, you know, nothing too weird as far as the chord changes was concerned. And really, that's how they coined the phrase bubblegum pop. But they didn't start out doing bubblegum music, actually. This is where it gets kind of interesting. You see, Kasnitz and Katz's first hit song they ever produced was a garage rock song called A Little Bit of Soul, which is definitely different than bubblegum pop, because garage rock was more of a heavy, you know, definitely more of an angsty sort of a punk. There was a definitely sort of more of a punk rock-esque kind of a thing to it, but we'll talk more about that in another episode of this podcast. And that definitely wasn't a bubblegum record because they brought in the band and recorded them without any other outside musicians. And the sound on the record was very raw. And the lead singer's voice sounded more rock and more like Jim Sons, The Shadows of Night, Alex Chilton, The Box Tops. But they only had one hit with that band. And when they couldn't keep the hit train rolling with them, that's when they started to focus on other projects. Okay. So basically what happened is that after A Little Bit of Soul was released on Lori Records, a New York record that offices in the Brill Building, and it became a huge hit, peaking at number 2 in the summer of 1967, Jeff and Jerry decided to part ways with Lori after Neil Bogart, the head of A&R and Buddha Records, another New York Brill Building label owned by a guy named Artie Rip, hired them on as staff producers. Now, here is where we're going to get more into the history behind this band, 1910 Fruit Gum Company, because this was one of the first bands that Jeff and Jerry ever worked with as staff writers and producers for Buddha Records. Okay, so A lot of you on here, if you've made it this far into this podcast, a lot of you are probably wondering more about this band, because I've mentioned before that a lot of the bubblegum songs are recorded with session singers and musicians, but the band performing the song was not the same band that, you know, played on the records, or the band that was, you know, touring and playing these songs live. They weren't the same guys in the records. So I wanted to make something clear to you about the story of this band. Some of you you're listening right now, they might be confused as to whether or not this was a real band or if it was a band created by Jeff and Jerry. The producers, Jerry Katz and Jeff Katz, with the music being written and produced by their staff songwriters and session musicians. And, you know, 1910 Frugum Coming, that was a name that they just came up with, you know, to call this specific project. That was all them. Well, the answer to this question isn't just a straight yes or no. It's actually a combination of both. But first, I'm going to go over the no part of the answer, because there's some truth to what I just said, and there's some things that aren't so true. But, you know, let's get into that. You know, let's talk about the no part of it. Okay, so you see, before Kazitz and Katz got involved with the project, what became the 1910 Frugum Company was, in fact, a real band, you know. But their original name was Jekyll and the Hydes, you know, and basically they were a bunch of guys from Linden, New Jersey, and they consisted of Frank Jekyll, Steve Markowitz, Pat Garwin, Floyd Marcus, and Mark Dukowski. And you got to keep in mind, you know, these guys, you know, even though they had a bubblegum image at the time, they were also really into the heavy psychedelic rock stuff too. So how they became a bubblegum band is pretty interesting. So essentially what happened was that they recorded a demo of, you know, them accompanying themselves on their instruments at Dick Charles Studios in New York. And one of the band members' friends passed the demo on to Jerry Kasnis and Jeff Katz. And they heard it and they liked it and they signed the group to Buddha Records. And while the band had their own desire to write their own songs as B-sides of singles and as album cuts, their producers, and I'm talking about, again, Jerry Kazitz and Jeff Katz, they had other plans. Okay, so when it came time to record the band's first single in the fall of 1967, by the way, it was the producers of the band, Jeff and Jerry, who decided they wanted to change the group's name to 1910 Frugum Company. And, you know, basically what happened was that I'm not really sure exactly how they got the name 1910 Frugum Company, but there is the possibility that Frank Jekyll, who is one of the main guys in the band, saw a rapper, they were in the middle of rehearsal and they saw like a rapper, you know, a bubblegum rapper where it said where it had the label 1910 on it, and that's when they decided to change the name of that band. But anyways, Jeff and Jerry, who are the producers, who are there again, Jerry Katz and Jeff Katz, they had one of their staff writers. They just got signed to Buddha as writers and producers. They had one of their staff writers, Elliot Shipwright, write a song for the group called Simon Says. And originally, when they presented the song to the band, the song had a calypso beat. It wasn't exactly how it was sounding when they recorded it. And the band wasn't too fond of how the song sounded originally. They weren't like big fans of the tune when they first heard it. But when they went into the studio to record the song, and keep in mind, when they did this, they accompanied themselves playing their own instruments. I mean, what you're hearing on their very first single is members of 1910 Frugum Company, not studio musicians, who are, and this is basically on their first hit single. One of the members was joking around with the song, and they decided to give the song a Woolly Bully flavor. And basically what they did is that they jokingly said, oh, well, let's basically count off as a Woolly Bully kind of a song. All right, guys, it's time to play a game of Simon Says. And they did the organ riff. Da-na-na-na. And then basically they jokingly counted it off that way. And, you know, they did the Sam the Sham style count off, and just as they were rolling the tape, and basically, you know, that combined Woolly Bully sound, you know, plus the band's use of the compact organ, and that sound worked, actually. And they actually, and they decided, you know, the Jeff and Jerry decided to release the tune in very late 1967, and then made the charts in the late winter, early springtime of late 1968. And by the way, Simon Says was the name of the song is actually a play on the old children's game, which is Simon Says. And again, like, the reason why they were doing this was so that way they can appeal to that preteen kids market who were playing games like that, like Simon Says. Basically, that was a very popular game that kids used to play back in the 60s. I mean, essentially, it was a game where it says Simon Says, go do this, and Simon Says, go do that. You know, basically, that's kind of the game that kids used to play back in the 60s, and that's why they wrote a song with that specific game in mind. And though the band had one more original follow-up single after that, the next big hit wouldn't happen until the summer of 1968. And now that we're going to talk, now we're going to talk about the history behind last week's song, which is 1-2-3 Red Light. Okay, so like their first hit record, 1-2-3 Red Light was written by Super K, the name of Jerry Cass and Jeff Cass production company staff writers. It was written by two guys named Sal and Bobby Dramachi. And when Simon Says became a huge hit, they basically, what happened was that they decided to keep the sort of game theme going with their hit singles, because Simon Says was a huge hit, and that was a play off a children's game. So they figured that the next hit song would also be a play on another children's game called Red Light, Green Light. And that's when they decided to do 1-2-3 Red Light as their next single, you know, again, to keep up that whole game thing that they were doing with their first hit. And basically what happened was that how the song came about is that Jeff and Jerry basically kept the band, you know, that played on their first album out on the road touring, and they basically cut the tracks for their second album without the core members of the band and with their own personal musicians. And again, I'm talking about Jerry Cass and Jeff Katz. And the only member of the 1970 Fruit Company that's on 1-2-3 Red Light is the lead singer Mark Dukowski. So basically what happened was that they were busy out on the road touring, and they actually didn't find out about 1-2-3 Red Light until they got interviewed at a radio station, and the disc jockey asked them about the record, and they all looked at each other clueless. They didn't even know about it except for Mark Dukowski. He was the only person that really knew about the record. So obviously he was the one who sang on their record. So, you know, they obviously, you know, they didn't know about it because they were busy out on the road touring. And basically, if you're wondering, okay, so if the members of 1970 Fruit Company didn't play on 1-2-3 Red Light, then who were the musicians on 1-2-3 Red Light if it wasn't members of the band? Well, on the Super K website, the musicians that are listed as far as the session guys who are playing on this song, and plus all the Super K productions, you know, that Jeff and Jerry did with other groups like the Crazy Elephant and the Ohio Express, the guitar players, you know, were Jimmy Calvert and Paul Naumann, with Jimmy Calvert playing lead guitar and Paul Naumann on rhythm guitar, Norm Manzano on bass, Steve Feldman and Kenny Laguna on keyboards, and Joji Andrea on drums. Now, as far as what studio these songs are recorded at, to be honest with you, I don't really know exactly where they recorded these songs, because most of the albums that were released for 1970 Fruit Gum Company, they did not list an engineer or the name of the studio that they recorded these songs. But there was one particular album that was produced by Jeff and Jerry, who did all the 1970 Fruit Gum Company hits and the Ohio Express hits. And, you know, and basically it was one of those albums where they got all their studio musicians and singers together and basically recorded the album under the name the Kazes and Cats Orchestral Chorus, which is basically their musicians and singers going under one name moniker. And it's on that album, it said that it was recorded at Allegro Sound Studios, which leads me to think that 90% of their records were cut at the studio, which is more than likely true, because one band that I did on my podcast a while back, and that was Tommy James and Shondells, they recorded all of their early hits at Allegro Sound Studios. And that band was deeply connected with Kazetz and Katz. How so? Well, basically what happened was that the writing and production team of Tommy James' early hits, Bobby Bloom, Bo Gentry, and Richie Cordell, were once working for Roulette Records, you know, producing for Tommy James, doing songs like I Think We're Alone Now and Mirage and I Like the Way and stuff like that. But once Morris Levy decided not to pay them their due royalties that they're entitled to earn after all the hits they made for label, they moved to Buddha Records and became staff writers for Super K Productions. And essentially what happened is that they brought the whole bubblegum sound that they had developed with Tommy James and Sean Dells over to Buddha Records with Jerry Kazness and Jeff Katz and started using the same production arrangement ideas for their groups like 1910 Frucum Company and Ohio Express. In fact, a Super K staff musician who played on a lot of those hits, Kenny Laguna, who played keyboards in a lot of those hits, also was a session musician for Tommy James and Sean Dells. He actually played on Money Money. And as you can see, there really is no doubt in my mind that they all shared a recording studio back in the day, since both those groups were so intertwined with each other. But really, I mean, the whole connection between Tommy James and Sean Dells in 1910 Frucum Company, it doesn't really surprise you once you kind of look at it, because if you listen to I Think We're Alone Now, which was one of Tommy James' earliest biggest hits, you'll notice that eighth note bass line thing that is so attached with bubblegum music, you know, that's in a ton of bubblegum songs, the eighth note bass line thing first appeared in I Think We're Alone Now in late 66, early 67, and then like a year or two later, it would appear on those bubblegum records produced by Jerry Kazness and Jeff Katz. So I'm pretty sure they carried that over from Tommy James and Sean Dells over to groups like 1910 Frucum Company and the Ohio Express. But anyways, the song was released in July of 1968, 1-2-3 Red Light, and by the fall, it was in the top 10, and the band had a couple of more top 40 hits after that, specifically a huge one called Indian Giver. But the main thing I want to say about this whole bubblegum genre music before I end this podcast is that it was meant to sort of give listeners a contradiction between the really heavy psychedelic album rock groups like Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Joe Cocker. It was supposed to be sort of an alternative to all that. It was supposed to be meant as sort of this kid-friendly, sort of innocent, fun pop thing that, you know, the younger preteens could get into that weren't really into the album rock stuff. And basically, even though the whole bubblegum music craze ultimately started by Jerry Kazness and Jeff Katz, it was basically taken over the pop charts by 68, 69. But once that happened, other A&R guys and other producers, you know, for other labels also started to get into this whole bubblegum genre music as well. And those people included Don Kirshner and Barry Gordy jumping on this exact same craze by introducing their own groups within that genre, following the same status quo of behind-the-scenes writers and producers making all the music while the singers are brought in simply to sing the songs. And this included groups like the fake cartoon group The Archies. And by the way, The Archies is a cartoon show that was put on by Screen Gems back in the late 60s, early 70s. And essentially what happened was that, you know, the actual music by The Archies was recorded by New York studio musicians and singers, but there was no such band as The Archies. It was just a cartoon. And the Jackson 5, you know, which was Motown's entrance in the bubblegum genre, you know, and basically this all happened like in the very end of the 60s, very beginning of the 70s. And essentially across the pond in the early 70s, there's another version of this whole bubblegum craze happening over there too, with several fake studio musicians and singer groups that were created with them all sharing the same lead singer, Tony Burrows. And these groups include the Edison Lighthouse, the First Class, and the White Plains, and a bunch of other groups. And to put it bluntly, like I said before, all these groups are created to fill a void in the market for the young preteens who are watching Saturday morning cartoons and eating cereal and chewing bubblegum. And 90% of these songs were written specifically for them in mind, because they did not want to listen to the more progressive, heavier rock bands like Deep Purple and Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Instead, they wanted something more lighthearted with less substance compared to those other bands. So there definitely was a place for bubblegum music back in the 60s, regardless of whether or not you like this music or not. Because trust me, I would want to mention there's a lot of songs within this very specific genre of music I'm not personally a fan of. But again, once you kind of have a good understanding of this was specifically, they wrote this music specifically for that teen market that didn't really want to hear the really heavy psychedelic rock stuff, then you understand that there was definitely a place for this very specific genre of music back in the late 60s, early 70s. And I feel like this kind of continues today, because I feel like a lot of the pop music of today, like the mainstream stuff, like Justin Bieber, I feel like it continues on that whole bubblegum thing that was going on in the late 60s, early 70s, except it's even worse now. I mean, just giving an example, Justin Bieber's latest hit, Yummy, is actually, you know, there's a bubblegum song back in the 60s by the Ohio Express called Yummy, Yummy, Yummy. So again, you can kind of understand that they continue that whole sort of cringeworthy sort of lyrical sort of, you know, thing that was going on with bubblegum music back in the 60s. It's still kind of going on today, like right now, you know, and just goes to show you that not all the songs back in the 60s were incredible, awesome songs. So that concludes part 2 of episode number 90 of my 60 Music Podcast, a Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and if you found out some really cool and interesting and mind-blowing facts about this week's song and artist in this very specific genre of music, you never really knew anything about this band, the 19th Frugal Company, or the song before, you can definitely let me know that by emailing me at samltwilly@icloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies. And as always, you can check out more of my original music at samwilliamsmusic.net. Also, as per usual, the things you can check out there in the description of this episode of this podcast are a link to last week's song and the link to the Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. So you'll be able to find all songs I've talked about my show so far, including some of the ones I've done interview episodes. Now, why I have both Spotify and YouTube playlists is for those of you on here who don't use Spotify but have YouTube, or vice versa. I love it if you can email me any ideas you have for songs I should talk about next on my show. But before you do that, I love it if you can please check out the Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast, because there you'll be able to get a good idea for what kind of songs I talk about on my show, and hopefully that will give you some ideas for the songs I should talk about next on my podcast that I haven't covered on my show yet. And if that does, please email those ideas to me at samltwilly@icloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram and let me know those ideas as well. And also, you can check out the official Redbubble merch store for this podcast, which is also linked to that in the description of this episode of this podcast. There you'll be able to find this super cool logo that I came up with that I had somebody else design. It's basically the catchphrase I say at the end of every episode and keep on trucking to that font with the name of my podcast in the bottom. We'll love it if you can go on there and maybe check out some of the items in the store, and hopefully you can purchase something. But if you don't want to, it's perfectly fine. But I would love it if you don't want to purchase anything, to at least give me some feedback on the price of each item in the store. And you can do that by emailing me at samltwilly@icloud.com. Or you can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies. And also, would love if you can give me some feedback on the logo itself, too, what you think of that as well. And so that wraps it up for this week's episode of this podcast. I'll let you guys know as soon as I have the next interview episode slated for the 100th interview for the 100th episode of this podcast. I'll let you guys know when that happens. We're 9 weeks away from that right now, but I'll let you guys know when I have the official interview episode slated for that next. But anyway, so I'm Sam Williams, and thank you for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next week, please keep things groovy.